voice of America in Washington. This is VOA Global. I'm Jim Stevenson.
Hi, Jim. I'm Ira Melman. On today's really big program, voters in one U.S. city have voted to pay a tax on the purchase of sugar-laden soft drinks. You'll hear about the battle the beverage industry waged against it.
Michael Lippin reports on what Malaysia is planning as it prepares to host the 2015 ASEAN meetings.
We get the reading by a U.S.-based stock analyst on the first week of trading on the Hong Kong Shanghai Stock Connect.
David Byrd will explore a new take on loving your dog and what it might mean for your life.
And in Science World Express, Rick Pantaleo talks about why some talented athletes fail to perform well under pressure.
All that and more on VOA Global from the Voice of America. This is Daybreak Asia, a summary of Asian news and events for Monday, November 24th. I'm Jim Stevenson. Glad to have you along. In brief today, Myanmar opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi says she and her supporters will continue pushing to amend a constitutional clause that bars her from running for president next year. She sat down for an exclusive interview with the VOA Burmese service Sunday, and the Nobel laureate said it is vital that she and her supporters continue to lobby for change. She was responding to Myanmar Army Chief Min Aung Hlaing, who was dismissive of an NLD effort that collected 5 million signatures to amend the constitution. In an exclusive and rare interview with VOA Sunday, the general said the constitutional clause in question is not aimed at Aung San Suu Kyi. The powerful armed forces chief reportedly held discussions with Aung San Suu Kyi for the first time late last month during unprecedented talks among 14 of Myanmar's political rivals and military leaders. The talks led to commitments to discuss political reforms and peace talks, but many opposition figures criticized the meeting as avoiding meaningful dialogue. In China, officials say an earthquake has hit a thinly populated area of western China, leaving at least 4 people dead and more than 50 injured. The U.S. Geological Survey put the magnitude of the quake at 5.9 in a depth of 14 kilometers and said it struck late Saturday afternoon in Sichuan Province. The state-run Xinhua News Agency reported Sunday 42 students were injured in a stampede at a primary school while they were trying to run for safety. In another earthquake, cleanup has begun in the mountainous area of central Japan, where a powerful 6.8 magnitude quake struck late Saturday. That one injured at least 39 people and caused several homes to collapse. The quake was centered near Nagano and was felt as far away as Tokyo. Since the quake hit inland, no tsunami warnings were issued. The quake also temporarily halted high-speed train service, and it caused several major roads to cave in and shut down others because of landslides. During the monsoon rains in northwest Bangladesh, swollen rivers can flood villages for months at a time. For the rural poor who rely on agriculture, there's no way to make money. But now some people are building some small floating farms where they grow vegetables and raise animals right on top of the floodwaters. Amy Yee reports for VOA from Dhaka.
Dozens of ducks quack as the Fisa Khatun gathers eggs in this unusual coop. It floats on water. The coop sits on top of a bamboo platform and empty oil drums and is moored to a riverbank near the village of Charbangura. On this floating farm, women villagers also raise fish and vegetables. Beyond the farm, boats chug along the river. Before tending the floating farm, 25-year-old Khatun could not earn money. She has 2 small children and no education. Her husband makes money during piecemeal agricultural work. But his livelihood is wiped out during the monsoon rains from July to October, when waters in the Kurmani River rise at least 3 meters. 3 years ago, a Bangladeshi nonprofit called Shirlai Swanirbhar Sangsa introduced small floating farms for rural women. The structures are 17 meters long and nearly 5 meters wide and made of recycled and local materials. Long bamboo rails extend from the duck coop, creating enclosures to raise tilapia and fishing nets. Vegetables such as gourds and beans grow in old plastic containers filled with soil. And the pots are fixed to the bamboo rails. Shidalai pays for the initial costs of the farm. For Khatun and other villagers, life is hard during the flood season. She says when the water comes, our house goes underwater. There's devastating impact of flood. There's no place to go, no place to stay. Water is all around. It's a fitting idea for Bangladesh, a country with hundreds of rivers. Because it is low-lying, Bangladesh is highly vulnerable to climate change, and flooding could get worse. People must find ways to adapt to rising waters and come up with other ways to make a living. Rural people without work migrate to overcrowded cities in Bangladesh, one of the world's most densely populated countries, with 156 million people. Rezwan says there is big demand for solutions for climate change-affected areas.
Bangladesh is in the front line of climate change. And we have hundreds of rivers in the country. So this project has a big potential to be scaled up within the country and also in other developing countries, particularly the countries that would be affected by the climate change.
So far, Shidlai has set up 40 floating farms that serve about 300 women. Rezwan wants to create 400 farms to serve 3,000 women and their families in the next few years. Shidlai's school boats have been copied in several other countries, including the Philippines, Cambodia, Vietnam, Nigeria, and Zambia. Khatun had never raised ducks or fish before the training, but her farm is flourishing. She says nothing has been very difficult. Amy Yee for VOA News, Dhaka.
Five years after 58 people, more than half of the media workers, were killed in the southern Philippines, no convictions have been made and scores of suspects remain at large. From Manila, Simone Orendain reports.
Philippine and international journalists are remembering the massacre in Maguindanao province on November 23, 2009, with a repeated call for justice. Mike Dobby of the International Federation of Journalists has led missions to the southern Philippines for the past 5 years. He calls the Philippine justice system broken because of the significant number of people still at large.
There seem to be no substantial reasons for why these 84 suspects have not been rounded up and detained. We know the justice system is broken because at least four witnesses have been killed before they can give their evidence in this trial.
111 people have been arraigned for the murders, while two of the suspects turned state witness. The main suspects belong to a powerful political clan, the Ampatuans. Andal Ampatuan and his sons Andal Jr. and Saldi have all pleaded not guilty to carrying out the ambush that saw the wife and sisters of their political rival, as well as supporters and 32 journalists, killed. Members of the International Federation of Journalists and the National Union of Journalists of the Philippines met with Philippine Justice Secretary Leila de Lima Saturday. IFJ Asia Pacific Acting Director Jane Worthington says they are cautiously optimistic because they learned that some changes are being made in the prosecution of those suspected of murdering journalists. However, Worthington says the Federation will list the Philippines as one of the worst in the world in terms of its impunity situation. Simone Orendain for VOA News, Manila.
I'm Jim Stevenson. Daybreak Asia comes to you every weekday on VOA Global. It's also a podcast. Subscribe for free at voanews.com.
This program is called VOA Global, and as you might have gathered, VOA stands for Voice of America. That's where we are. I'm Ira Melman, he's Jim Stevenson, and now it's time for your input.
We had several stories on our website that people have reacted to. Afghan lawmakers approved security accords with U.S. and NATO. As Afghanistan's lower house of parliament approves agreements with the United States and NATO, that allows international forces to remain in the country past the end of this year.
And Lawrence Bush from Houston, Texas, wrote us an entire new nonfiction book about this. He says, it's welcome as our combat operations to prepare beyond this year in Afghanistan against the Taliban insurgents and the Al-Qaeda combination. In the current context, the geopolitical scenario does focus upon the Middle East fighting ISIS. It's too true. The Afghanistan sector still stands volatile. And he goes on about that. Quite interesting stuff.
The Korea's on edge amid live fire drills. It's been another tense week in the Korean Peninsula as North Korea threatened to again test nuclear weapons, while the United States and South Korean forces held joint military exercises. We heard from Davis Thanchen from New York, who writes, South Korea has reason to worry the military escalations in North Korea and the new nuclear bomb tests. What did South Korea do after the armistice to defend itself? Nothing.
Well, we heard from Ben in the United States saying South Korea has one of the largest standing armed forces in the entire world. They're very modern and well-trained. They asked for help from the U.S. and we're happy to provide it, but don't confuse this with dependence.
We've got many more stories on our website at voanews.com. We're also on Facebook, Weibo, and Twitter. Many ways for you to contact us and tell us what you think about the stories that you read at VOA. This is VOA Global on the Voice of America. I'm Jim Stevenson along with Ira Melman. We've got China news coming up. It's China Focus with Sarah Williams. But before that,
Michael Lippin will be here. Malaysia, one of the original members of ASEAN, will be hosting ASEAN next year. And VOA got an exclusive interview with the Malaysian ambassador to the United States. That is coming up. Michael will tell you all about that coming up on VOA Global. Right here on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Asian political scene on VOA Global. I'm Michael Lippin. Malaysia is preparing for an influential year on the world stage. In January, it will assume the 2015 chairmanship of the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, or ASEAN, while also taking a seat on the UN Security Council. One of Malaysia's priorities for ASEAN is to encourage the 10-nation group to form an economic community for its 650 million people. ASEAN is hoping to launch the economic community by the end of 2015. Its member states must remove more trade barriers for that to happen. Some small businesses in Southeast Asia worry that such trade moves could make it harder for them to compete. Malaysian Ambassador to the U.S., Awang Adek Hussein, visited VOA last week to discuss that issue. My colleague Sopat Song asked Hussein how Malaysia views the process of ASEAN integration.
We are in ASEAN, we always take things step by step. When we say integration, it's not going to be integration in the context of European community. It's not in the context of United States or America. First step of integration in ASEAN is, of course, the economic integration. And where now we have more than 80% of all goods traded are having zero tariff already. So it's just a matter of moving, stepping up to 100% in a year, you know, that we are working towards that. But it doesn't mean that it's going to sort of have immediate adverse impacts on individuals in different countries. In fact, if at all, it's going to bring more opportunities of trade. Intra-ASEAN trade has already gone up. You know, of course, you know, probably there's some feeling of some countries not ready, some people in certain region not ready. But it's okay. I mean, we can come along at our own pace, you know. The fact that all countries agree to set up, to establish this ASEAN economic community by the end of 2015 is already a good milestone, a good step.
I have one last question just to wrap up our conversation here. January 2015 is the start of Malaysia as the chair of ASEAN and also in the Security Council. Do you see any linkages between Malaysia's role in the region and its agenda for ASEAN with its agenda at the UN Security Council?
Yes. First of all, I think Malaysia is very thankful of all the support, especially ASEAN, because Malaysia's candidature not only seen as Malaysia's, but also ASEAN candidature, you know, fully backed by ASEAN and also Asia-Pacific. So, you know, we are certainly not only grateful, but we'd be responsive to what the advice and interests of ASEAN member countries. And we certainly will use the United Nations Forum to continue with what Malaysia believes in strongly. One is, of course, in terms of this moderate movement. You know, moderation, we think, is very key in the face of these extremist, developments taking place, all over the world. So Malaysia believes strongly in the moderation approach. And we also, Malaysia has always been a principal player. We speak out against injustice, and we always look into the interests of the less fortunate countries and smaller countries. So this is what Malaysia has been in terms of our foreign policy. So I'm sure much of it will continue. And, we will try to link up as much as possible to the development of ASEAN, since Malaysia is also chairman of ASEAN. And I'm sure that, this will be beneficial to not only Malaysia, but to ASEAN in general.
That was Malaysian Ambassador to the U.S., Awang Adek Hussein. We'll be back next week for another look at the Asian political scene. I'm Michael Lippin.
I'm Sarah Williams with China Focus. Leaders of the world's two top greenhouse gas polluters recently agreed to take steps to rein in their planet-warming emissions. China, for the first time, set a date for its emissions to peak, and the U.S. pledged new cuts beyond what it had already announced. Experts say they are good steps if the countries follow through. VOA's Steve Barragona has more.
Chinese smokestacks put out more carbon dioxide than any other countries, more even than the world's largest economy, the United States. So the announcement by U.S. President Barack Obama and Chinese President Xi Jinping was significant, says Duke University climate policy expert Tim Profeta.
You cannot solve this problem with the U.S. and China alone, but there's no way you're going to solve this problem without the U.S. and China taking action.
Xi pledged for the first time that China's emissions would peak in 2030. The country aims to get 20% of its energy needs from zero carbon sources by then. That would mean adding more renewable energy than the country currently generates from coal-fired power plants. President Obama committed to cut U.S. emissions by about a quarter below 2005 levels by 2025. The White House says that's double the current pace of reduction.
This is an ambitious goal, but it is an achievable goal.
But it's a goal that would face opposition from incoming leaders of Congress, including likely Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell.
As I read the agreement, requires the Chinese to do nothing at all for 16 years while these carbon emission regulations are creating havoc in my state and other states around the country.
Even if both sides reach their targets, this deal alone will not be enough to avert dramatic climate change impacts, Profeta says.
You can't look at the numbers here and think, oh, this will satisfy our need to reduce greenhouse gases over the next century. The significance of this step is that these two countries are taking steps to get on the right trajectory and hopefully will inspire and accelerate action in the future.
Experts hope the U.S.-China agreement will result in progress on a global deal at the upcoming climate summit in Peru in December. Steve Barragona, VOA News, Washington.
Chinese journalist Gao Yu has gone on trial for allegedly spreading state secrets. And in Xinjiang Friday, Uyghur academic Ilam Todi had his appeal of a life sentence for separatism denied. Shannon Van Sant reports on the trials that the Amnesty International Rights Group says expose China's deep hypocrisy to the rule of law.
The 70-year-old journalist Gao Yu went on trial Friday in Beijing. China has accused her of leaking state secrets. Her hearing came on the same day that a Chinese court rejected the appeal of lawyer and academic Ilam Todi, who was convicted in September on charges of separatism. Both trials come after China's central government has said improving rule of law is a priority under its agenda for reform. The Xinjiang High Court hearing of Todi's appeal was held inside an Urumqi detention center, which is not part of normal judicial procedure in China. The hearing also was scheduled at such short notice that neither of Todi's lawyers was able to attend. When asked whether Friday's hearing in Xinjiang reflected improvement in China's rule of law and judiciary system, China's foreign ministry spokesperson Hong Lei said the handling of this case is a part of China's progress in rule of law. Governing the country according to law was the official theme of this year's Communist Party plenum, during which China granted local courts greater autonomy from the party. Chinese officials also now have to swear loyalty to China's constitution. William Ni is a China researcher with Amnesty International.
I think there are ways in which the government is showing that it wants to improve its criminal justice system and make it more fair.
But the handling of Gao and Todi's cases have raised questions about the promised reforms of China's judicial system. Gao was detained in secret on April 24th and formally arrested May 30th. CCTV, or Chinese state television, later broadcast a televised confession from Gao, which her brother said this week was made under duress. Todi's September trial was also closed door. Ni says Todi was denied food for 10 days and his legs were shackled. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Beijing.
Follow us on Weibo. That's China Focus. I'm Sarah Williams.
From the Voice of America, this is Asian Business News. The Shanghai-Hong Kong Stock Connect is permitting international investors to trade some stocks between Shanghai and Hong Kong markets. It's been open a week now. I spoke with Patrick O'Hare about it, chief market analyst at Briefing.com in Chicago.
Well, I think the U.S. is looking at the Stock Connect system as a progressive move. It's opening up the Chinese market to more foreign capital, more foreign investment, which is regarded as a positive step given what a lot of outside investors anyway perceive as a great growth opportunity into the Chinese market based on the urbanization effort that's underway in China.
Now, what is the situation as far as the few days that this has been in operation? It almost seems like a northward-bound trek. Nobody seemingly coming from the mainland to Hong Kong. How do you read that?
Well, we think, part of that is owed to the fact that there's a restriction in terms of going southbound in terms of the account balance. Mainland investors have an account balance of at least 500,000 renminbi, which essentially limits that investment opportunity to the wealthiest individuals in China. And so that's one factor that we think is restricting some of those flows southbound. The other thing, though, is that you probably have somewhat of a home bias, if you will. Chinese investors on the mainland are comfortable with doing business in the areas that they know and are familiar with. And when you have a new system that potentially introduces new rule changes or new things, after you've been set in your ways for a long time, it takes a while to adjust to that. And, of course, the authorities didn't do themselves any favors, really, by pretty much thrusting this program out or the launch of it on a very short notice. I mean, gave institutional investors and retail investors alike about a week's notice before the launch date. And so we think there's really just more of an adjustment period here that is limiting some of those flows.
Patrick O'Hare, chief market analyst at Briefing.com, here on The Voice of America.
This is Today in History. On this date in 1859, English naturalist Charles Darwin published On the Origin of Species. In it, Darwin postulated that living organisms evolved over time through the process of natural selection. Also in 1922, the Italian Parliament gave Benito Mussolini dictatorial powers for 1 year. The fascist Mussolini went on to rule Italy until his overthrow during World War II. In 1944, Tokyo was bombed by 88 American aircraft during World War II. It was the beginning of mass bombing raids on the Japanese capital that continued until Japan surrendered. In 1963, Lee Harvey Oswald, the accused assassin of President John F. Kennedy, was shot and killed on live television at the Dallas, Texas police headquarters. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
There's an old saying, Ira, that the best things in life are free. And, well, guess what? We've got something free for all of you. It's our new 2015 VOA calendar. You can follow the entire year with scenes of the southwestern United States. And all you have to do is write to us, ask for your free calendar. Our email address is voaasia@voanews.com. And you can also contact us in a variety of other ways. We're on Facebook, Weibo, Twitter. Write in now. Get your free 2015 VOA calendar. The address again, voaasia@voanews.com.
From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. World powers and Iran negotiate an extension of nuclear talks. Iraqi forces defend Ramadi from Islamic State. Malaysia jet wreckage cleared from eastern Ukraine. Those stories and more coming up. I'm Ray Kugel. The United States and other world powers trying to negotiate a deal with Iran to curb its nuclear development program are now looking to extend their talks past their self-imposed Monday deadline. VOA's Al Pessin reports.
Most of the top-level work at these talks has been done by Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif and U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry, who met again on Sunday. They've been joined briefly by several other foreign ministers, but now, as the deadline looms, the foreign ministers of Germany, France, and Britain headed for Vienna again, and there were reports that their Russian and Chinese counterparts would also attend the final scheduled day of talks Monday. The gathering led to speculation by some observers that agreement might be near, but others argue that the complexity of the issues and acknowledged significant remaining gaps mean the best that can be hoped for is another extension of the deadline. The six nations have been deputized by the UN Security Council to negotiate with Iran and find a formula that would allow it to maintain a peaceful nuclear program with verifiable limits and guarantees it could never build a nuclear weapon. In return, Iran wants relief from crippling economic sanctions. Officials indicate that the extent and timing of all aspects are still in play. Al Pessin, VOA News, Vienna.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu voiced new fears Sunday that the countries negotiating with Iran will leave it with the ability to create a nuclear weapon. Afghan officials say a suicide bomber killed at least 50 people during a volleyball tournament in the country's east. The match in Paktika province had drawn a large crowd. At least 80 other people were wounded in the attack. There's been no claim of responsibility. In Nigeria, authorities say a suspected Boko Haram gunman killed at least 25 people in the country's northeast. The victims were mostly fishermen in a remote community north of Maiduguri in Borno State. Some witnesses put the death toll at higher than 40. Tunisians voted Sunday in their first presidential election since the 2011 revolution that sparked the Arab Spring pro-democracy uprisings throughout the region. The vote marked the long-awaited completion of a transition to democracy after Tunisians overthrew dictator Zine al-Abidine Ben Ali 3 years ago. Official results have not been released. The United States says it is planning to buy arms for Sunni tribesmen in Iraq in an expanded effort to try to halt the advance of Islamic State militants. The Defense Department says the weapons purchase would cost more than $18 million. It is part of a broader $1.6 billion request for training Iraqi and Kurdish forces to fight the insurgents who have captured a large area of Iraq and Syria. The U.S. military says the weapons for the tribesmen would include assault weapons, rocket-propelled grenade launchers, grenades, and mortars. On the battlefront Sunday, Iraqi forces said they had retaken two cities from the Islamic State just over 100 kilometers northeast of Baghdad. At least 19 Kurdish Peshmerga and militia fighters were killed in the battle, along with about 50 insurgents. Arab media are saying Iraqi government forces are resisting an offensive by Islamic State militants in the Anbar provincial capital of Ramadi. Edward Uranian has details from our Middle East Bureau in Cairo.
Iraqi government aircraft fired on Islamic State attackers in the Anbar provincial capital of Ramadi Sunday as Sunni tribesmen battled to defeat a multi-pronged attack by the militants. Tribal leaders claim to be holding off the militants who are trying to infiltrate government-held parts of the city. Anbar provincial council head Sabah al-Karhut said Islamic State is waging a bitter battle for the city. He says the security threat against Ramadi Sunday is dire. He indicated that Sunni tribesmen were fighting the militants and have received 4 plane loads of arms from the government, but need still more. Al Arabiya TV reported Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi discussed the issue of arming Sunni tribesmen with Anbar officials Sunday. Parliament Speaker Salim al-Jabouri, a Sunni, demanded the government arm Anbar's Sunni tribesmen during a press conference in the Jordanian capital Amman on Sunday. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
Dutch air crash investigators have completed their recovery of the wreckage of a Malaysia Airlines passenger jet that was shot down over rubble-held eastern Ukraine 4 months ago. Workers sent the last pieces of the airplane on a train Sunday from the area controlled by pro-Russian separatists to the Ukrainian government-held city of Kharkiv. From there, the pieces of the aircraft will be transported to the Netherlands, where authorities are reconstructing the aircraft as part of their investigation. All 298 people aboard the flight last July from Amsterdam to Kuala Lumpur were killed in the crash. Two-thirds of them were from the Netherlands. The controversial former mayor of Washington, D.C., Marion Barry, has died at the age of 78. He suffered from a string of health problems, including diabetes and prostate cancer. Marion Barry was a polarizing figure in Washington politics, going back to his days as a civil rights activist.
Preserve.
Preserve.
Protect.
Protect.
And defend the laws of the District of Columbia.
And defend the laws of the District of Columbia.
The Constitution of the United States.
The Constitution of the United States.
That was Marion Barry, first elected as Washington's mayor in 1978. Voters returned him to that office 3 more times, racking up a string of accomplishments and failures. The former mayor and current district council member will always be remembered for a night 24 years ago in a Washington hotel where he was caught on videotape in an undercover operation smoking crack cocaine with a woman who was not his wife. That videotape of the mayor's hotel encounter and arrest made international headlines. After his release from prison for drug possession, he was elected to Washington City Council. 2 years later, he won his 4th and final term as mayor. A grand jury decision is not expected until at least Monday in the case of the killing of an unarmed African-American teenager by a white police officer in the central U.S. city of Ferguson, Missouri. A decision and announcement had been widely expected Sunday, but the grand jury is reported to still be gathering information about the deadly incident that occurred last August. The grand jury is considering whether to indict or exonerate Officer Darren Wilson. And that's it for this edition of International Edition. There's always more right here at VOAnews.com. I'm Ray Kugel. Enjoy the day.
With Jim Stevenson, I'm Ira Melman on the Voice of America. We're in Washington and time to check international business news. China's leadership and central bank are ready to cut interest rates again and also loosen lending restrictions. Concerned that falling prices could trigger a surge in debt defaults, business failures, and job losses. That according to a report by the Reuters news agency. The report says Friday's surprise cut in rates, the first in more than 2 years, reflects a change of course by Beijing and the central bank, which had persisted with modest stimulus measures before finally deciding last week that a bold monetary policy step was required to stabilize the world's second largest economy.
In the business of motion pictures, Mockingjay Part 1 didn't catch fire like the previous installments of The Hunger Games, but it still had the biggest opening of the year with $123 million at the weekend box office, according to studio estimates on Sunday. Lionsgate's Mockingjay opened well below the $158 million debut of last year's Hunger Games: Catching Fire and the $153 million opening of the 2012 original. But even with a $30 million plus slide in the franchise, Mockingjay far surpassed the previous top weekend of the year, the $100 million debut of Transformers: Age of Extinction.
In a bid for more customers and ultimately more sales, shopping malls and retailers are making holiday shopping an interactive and virtual experience, including the trip to see Santa. USA Today reports at least three companies have built virtual experiences for malls for the holidays, including DreamWorks, featuring Disney characters Shrek and Donkey, taking kids to the North Pole in 8 malls and another 10 at malls around the Disney hit Frozen Mall. Frozen.
That's
mall.
Right. We check business every day on VOA Global. With Ira Melman, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, we've got David Byrd and Now. And if you're a pet lover, you'll want to definitely check in David's segment. But before that, the American Cafe.
Well, maybe when David comes out and tells you about this, wait till you hear this, because you might feel guilty if you don't like dogs. And I am a dog lover and a dog owner, and I think you very well should feel guilty if you don't like dogs. But that's just my comment. I'm Ira Melman in the American Cafe. Pop open a sugary soft drink or soda, and you could find yourself gulping down a national debate in the United States. With growing diabetes and obesity rates, health policymakers have set their sights on sugar consumption. In Berkeley, California, a new soda tax called Measure D has passed with a 75% majority. After similar measures were defeated in other cities like nearby San Francisco as well as in New York City. VOA's Regina Catapon talked with Dr. Harold Goldstein, the director of the California Center for Public Health Advocacy, on how this tax will be implemented.
The tax is on distributors, those not on the retailers. Those distributors will pay the city a penny per ounce, and those funds are going to go into the general fund for the city of Berkeley to do what they see fit.
Why was there a need for the soda tax, both from an economic standpoint and from a public health standpoint?
I think a lot of people know that sugary beverages, soda and sports drinks and energy drinks, most people know that they're not great for you, but most people don't really know how harmful they are for you. And so we in the United States are in the midst of a massive diabetes epidemic, and it's a leading cause of amputations and blindness and the need for dialysis. But if we're gonna get a hold of our health care costs, the single most important thing that we can do is to reduce rates of diabetes. And the single most important thing we can do to reduce rates of diabetes is to get people to drink healthy beverages.
Why do you think this bill was successful in Berkeley, as opposed to the other cities that had similar measures?
I think the reason why it passed in Berkeley is Berkeley has a long history of grassroots organizing. So long before the beverage industry came into the city and started spending their millions of dollars, real people were informed about information shared about how harmful these beverages are. And they were told what to expect when the beverage industry comes in and starts spending millions of dollars. And the people of Berkeley took that step to say the health of our kids is more important than what keeping the price of a soda under a dollar.
How would you respond to the criticism that the tax disproportionately affects lower-income residents, the same residents that are likely to drink more soda and are also more likely to not be able to afford the tax?
I say that's hogwash. I think that is a beverage industry talking point that suggests that the beverage industry is particularly concerned about low-income residents and communities of color, and that is just simply not true. The beverage industry has been aggressively marketing to Latino and African-American low-income communities in this country for decades. Low-income residents and African-Americans, Latinos, Asians decide for themselves whether to support a soda tax or not. And when you ask them in Berkeley, by large margins, they said, we want the tax, and they also want the money to be used to help keep their kids healthy.
There's also the free marketplace criticism that taxes should not regulate the health of people and that soda consumption should be an unfettered and individual choice. Is there any truth to that?
When the beverage industry uses those arguments, it suggests that a soda tax somehow is prohibiting people from buying the product, and that is simply not true. If you were to do an analysis, as our center has done, it turns out that just in terms of the cost of obesity and the cost of treating obesity, it's about a penny an ounce. So in some ways, what the tax does is balance the marketplace and ensures that the price of sugary drinks takes into consideration the real price of those products.
VOA's Regina Catapon in the cafe. She spoke with Dr. Harold Goldstein, the director of the California Center for Public Health Advocacy. You can hear American Cafe every day at voanews.com and numerous podcast platforms. I'm Ira Melton.
Hi, everyone. I'm David Byrd, and here's what's happening now. There's an old idiom in the United States that goes, love me, love my dog. It's a way of asking someone to accept everything about you, including your pet. But it turns out that loving your dog could make you a better candidate for a relationship. For many people, dogs are constant companions and objects of deeply held feelings. But turns out they can also help you attract a partner. Several dating sites, such as PetsDating.com and YouMustLoveDogs.com, are helping singles in the United States meet around common interests, specifically their pets. Julie Spira is a Los Angeles-based dating expert and digital matchmaker. She told the Associated Press that finding that common interest is crucial to finding a good partner.
There are so many different flavors, and pets are really important. If you have a pet, you're so passionate about your pet. And if you meet someone that you feel all of their requirements, but they're allergic to your dog or cat, it's going to fall apart. It's like having a deal breaker with not dating a smoker if you can't date a smoker.
Some of these dating sites even encourage owners to bring their furry friends on a first date. Julie Spira says that pet lovers already have something in common, and that helps to make a connection.
So I really think it's a good idea to have a dating site that's based upon pets, where you can actually select the different breed. Maybe you've lost your German Shepherd a few years ago, and you'd like to meet someone, even if you don't have a dog, that has a German Shepherd puppy. It's a terrific idea.
Renee Piani is another dating expert and consultant and best-selling author. She told the AP that how a person treats their pet says a lot about how they would treat their partner.
When a person has an animal in their life, the way they treat their animal, the way they care for them, you can see how they will love possible children in the future, how they love you even. So it's really cool to observe how a man or woman watches and takes care of their animal.
But not all human-animal relationships are good indicators of a healthy love match. David Weigand is a dating coach in California. He told the Associated Press that sometimes the human-animal relationship is an unhealthy replacement for real person-to-person interaction.
I have found that they're actually relationship replacements. They have a dog and they talk about we. Matter of fact, one time I went out with a woman. She brought her little lap dog with me on our first date, right? Oh, kissing, 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 kissing. We had such a great weekend. She's talking about her and her dog in this whole thing. And I have found some of the loneliest people will take all their love, all their energy, and put it upon a dog or a cat or something else. So to me, I don't really find it that healthy.
In addition to online love connections, there were places like the Pussy and Pooch Pet Lifestyle Center in Beverly Hills. The store features what it calls the meat market, where dogs dine on gourmet food and their owners meet in a non-threatening environment. Vanessa Gonzalez is one of those at the store. She told the Associated Press that she and her partner believe the pet is an attraction for them and that it can help people develop a relationship.
You don't want to be with someone that doesn't love your dog, because I think a lot of people today see their pets as their children. So it's kind of like dating someone that didn't like your kid.
Robert Gaudio is the owner of the Pussy and Pooch store. He told the AP his business offers a variety of ways that people and their pets can meet and interact.
Each month is a different theme. It's casual and fun. It's some good off-leash play as well up in our social club. I truly think that our fur clients and our people clients, our human clients, we call, like our socials just the same. We've had many great love connection at our events, and we actually have a client baby that's on the way right now.
Several online dating sites cater to things other than animals, like political or religious affiliations, but pet-focused sites ask multiple questions about pet ownership and love of animals. So maybe that old idiom is close to the truth. If you love someone's pet, you might love that person. So what do you think? Do you have a pet? Would you date someone who didn't have or love their animals? Let us know your opinion by logging on to our Facebook page, VOA Asia. And remember, you can always email your questions or comments to voaasia@voanews.com. And that's what's happening now. Until next time, I'm David Byrd.
This is VOA Global from the Voice of America. I'm Ira Melman. He's Jim Stevenson.
Hello.
David is right. I mean, you just made a comment off the air that when we were single many years ago, all you needed was a dog.
That was
it. And you met women. Simple as that.
If you take a dog out on a leash where there are a lot of people milling about, all the women will come up to you.
Unless, of course, it's an aggressive pit bull.
Well, that's another story.
Then you got some problems. We're going to check sports coming up here on the Voice of America.
It's time for sports on VOA Global. Jim Stevenson with Ira Melman. You know, 15 years ago, Roger Federer debuted at the Davis Cup. He returned to the Tennis Cup on Sunday in Lille, France, winning the title for Switzerland. And despite a hostile reception by the French audience, Federer beat Richard Gasquet 6-4, 6-2, 6-2. Federer did make some mistakes, but returned games aggressively, varying with his backhand. This is the first Davis Cup win for both Federer and the Swiss team, something that was on Federer's list of wishes.
Well, I mean, we fought hard for it. I've been playing this game for almost 15 years now, and clearly I've never come as close as, this past weekend. So I'm happy I was able to stay calm and play a good match when I had to. And clearly I'm very happy for all the guys on the team. Everybody worked incredibly hard to get me match ready. This one's for the boys.
Well, on the other side of the net, the French captain Arnaud Clément now faces harsh criticism for his team management.
Henrik Stenson successfully defended his DP World Tour Championship on Sunday. Stenson birdied the final two holes to end with an overall 16-under 272.
It was a great week. I came here with a purpose, and I've kind of put my mind to trying to give it my all this last week here, and to manage to come through then is very special, and I'm very delighted.
Now ranked second to Rory McIlroy in the European Tour race to Dubai.
In Melbourne, Nick Cullen shot a 3-under par 69 to win the Australian Masters. Cullen nudged out past title champion Adam Scott by a stroke. Cullen hit an eagle at the par 5 fourth, and then he shot back-to-back birdies at number 11 and 12 to secure the title. Also in golf, Hideki Matsuyama beat Hiroshi Iwata in the Dunlop Phoenix held in Miyazaki, Japan. He started with a two-stroke lead and shot a 1-under par 70 before saving par on the extra hole. The Dunlop Phoenix is Matsuyama's first win this season on the Japanese Tour.
Manny Pacquiao versus Floyd Mayweather, both boxing fans. Pacquiao are tired of waiting after defeating Chris Algieri in Macau. Pacquiao expressed continued interest in fighting Mayweather, and that's probably going to come up soon. And that's a look at sports here on the Voice of America. This is the Voice of America. Sometimes, you know, things don't go perfectly. And I thought Jim was going to start talking.
Yeah,
and
I
Jim
thought you
thought I was going to start talking.
Let's listen to Rick Pantaleo talk for a little bit. He's got Science World Express.
I think maybe he'll talk this time.
This is Science World Express. I am Rick Pantaleo. Have you ever wondered why your favorite basketball player wasn't able to make that crucial shot, or why that talented football player missed a goal he should have made? Dr. Vikram Chib will tell us what he and his colleagues at Caltech found out about why talented athletes fail to perform well under pressure.
There are a lot of things going on here right now, right? There's numerous incentives. There's the social incentive associated with, you know, performing well for his teammates, as well as sometimes monetary incentives. So Athletes can make millions of dollars in bonuses depending on their performance. So all of those things come into play that and can cause somebody to choke under pressure. And what we found in our study was that it seems, at least in the case when large financial stakes are on the line, that how you perceive losses or how you feel about losses can really have a dramatic impact on your performance.
How much of this anxiety, these problems that basketball players or even artists who perform concerts or whatever, how much of the problems they have with choking results from mere psyching themselves, overthinking?
It's hard to know exactly what's going on in those situations. We've studied this specific case as looking at high-stakes financial conditions, but it seems that choking could be psychological, right? Because they've practiced these tasks over and over again. So clearly something is going wrong in the way they're processing what's at stake when they're doing these tasks. So I would say that it's psychological, but it still remains to be seen exactly like what is, in those situations, when you're an artist performing in front of a crowd or you're an athlete, what exactly is happening? So we think that in the case of financial incentives, it has to do with loss aversion. But in the case of the artist performing in front of a crowd or even the sports situation where there are social incentives involved, we're still trying to figure out what's going on there.
You were able to zero in on part of the brain that influences performance. Could you tell us a little bit about this and how that particular area of the brain affects performance?
The area that we sort of focused on was the ventral striatum. And that area is deep in your brain, and it's known to be involved in processing rewards. And it's also known to have some influences on motor performance, on how you move. And what we found in our study was that area was involved in mediating the responses of how people perform for given incentives. We also found that there was, specifically in the situation where people choke during movement tasks or tasks that require some motor dexterity, there's sort of a disconnect between ventral striatum, this part deep in your brain, and the motor cortex, which is involved in encoding your movements and how you move through when you're doing certain skilled tasks. So we think that a decoupling between the ventral striatum or these areas not being able to talk to each other very well is what causes you to choke under pressure.
Did you come across anything that was surprising?
This whole idea of loss aversion did come as a surprise to us because we were presenting people with potential gains. So we told them, you know, you're doing this task to win this money in certain situations. And so we were surprised that loss aversion could actually predict how they were going to perform in a case where there weren't any explicit losses. And we thought that the reason that this might be happening is because people are sort of reframing the task. They're thinking of it as a gain when they first see it in that condition where we offer them $100 to win, and then they start to get worried about a loss of the gain, even though they never received it, and this is sort of what gets them to choke under pressure. We were really surprised when we saw that.
Did you find any basis for developing a kind of a technique of self-help to help people and to keep them from choking under pressure?
I think it can be applied. So we're still trying to figure out exactly what the best cognitive strategies are to go about stopping people from choking under pressure. I think what our research suggests is that if you are worried about one of those people that are very worried about losses, one thing that you can do is to try and sort of not put so much stress on a single event, but rather think about all of the possibilities that you have to do well. So maybe keep a positive attitude where you're not so focused on loss. That can sort of help you. But the other thing that's interesting is what does research suggests by framing incentives properly, given somebody's loss aversion, you can have a drastic improvement in their performance. So as an example, your boss, if he knows your loss aversion, when he's setting up your bonuses, he can say, look, I know that you're very loss averse, so you'll actually respond better to an unconventional bonus where it's framed as a loss if you don't successfully achieve a task. So endow your employee with money and then take away if they're unsuccessful. And this way, you're sort of capitalizing on what their motivational tendencies are and how they process loss aversion. And this might be able to actually help them do better and achieve more of their bonus.
That was Caltech's Dr. Vikram Chib. Thanks for listening to Science World Express. We'd like you to visit our website at voanews.com/science.
I have often wondered about that. I mean, the psychology of sports is absolutely fascinating, and I just think that was interesting.
It was. However, fascinating.
What are you shopping for this holiday?
Oh, this holiday? I don't know. I've got a whole laundry list of things to pick up at the store, but there's one thing that I don't have on my list. In fact, it doesn't even have to do with laundry. It has to do with the bathroom.
Well, maybe it does have to do with laundry. You don't really know. How about the Kohler Company has introduced a deodorizing toilet seat. Says it eliminates embarrassing bathroom odors and the need for candles and sprays to cover them up.
There you go.
Fan hidden in the battery-operated seat sucks in the air, pushes it through an odor-eating carbon filter, followed by an optional scent pack. The product manager said the idea is to attack smells where the action is.
Yeah, they say it costs $90. You know what? I say open a window. It'd be far cheaper.
Well, you know, you've seen some ridiculous toilet devices around the world, like in Japan. That's going to wrap things up for us.
Tracy Carter is our director, Carl Starling at the controls for us as our engineer, and our managing editor is Diane Gao, who is absent today, and that's why we could do the toilet seat story.
Never again. Have yourself a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.
Bye.